Hi, I'm Bill Kristol. Welcome back to Conversations. I'm very pleased to be joined today again by Charles Murray, scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, author of many important books, Losing Ground in, 1984, and yes. The Bell Curve in the mid-90s, and Coming Apart about 4 years ago. Really, I would say, I'm not sure there's a social commentator who's written as many important books over the last three decades as Charles, so it's a great pleasure and honor to have you here. And you're going to explain the current moment, right?
With that kind of introduction, I suppose I'm obligated to.
Exactly, right. So what, this is the very beginning of August of 2016. Someone wrote something in the New York Times yesterday, sort of giving you credit for appreciatingly seeing that this, the Trump or Trumpism, I guess, was going to happen. Did you see it, and what do you make of it? How do we understand?
Well, I knew that we were going to have a problem with a white working class, and actually, I guess I'll blow my own horn and say in 1993 for the Wall Street Journal, I had a long article called The Coming of the White Underclass. And if you go back and read that, but this is not rocket science. It simply was the trend lines for out-of-wedlock births among working class whites at that point had been spiking upward. They were at about the level they had been when Pat Moynihan sounded the tocsin on black out-of-wedlock births in the early 1960s. And it did not take much foresight to see the same kinds of social problems were going to attend what was happening to whites. But where we stand now in 2016 is way worse than it was then. How did we get there?
Yeah. Well, and explain maybe very briefly what is way worse. What indicators would you cite if I said, I don't know, the country seems to be in decent shape, you know?
Yeah, for those of you who don't hang out in working class communities or who grew up in one but haven't been back to visit recently, you will probably be shocked. The reason you will be shocked is that a town that you knew 30 years ago, 40 years ago, as a town of intact families and no more serious drug problem than some beer and marijuana, will now find meth use is a huge problem and increasingly heroin use. You will find on the order of 18% of the single white males in that community of working age who are not even looking for work. That's a lot of people. You will see single-parent families all over. You will see children who are not performing well in school, who are delinquent. Basically, Bill, you can take all of the things that social scientists were shaking their heads over about the black inner city in the 1970s and 80s, and all of those things are happening in white working class America now. It's really, truly not only unprecedented, but it's of a different nature than the problem in the black inner cities for a very brutal reason. Blacks constitute around 12% of the American population. Non-Latino whites, depending how you define it exactly, but we're still looking at high 60%, around 70, a little bit lower than that. That's a group that's about four times as large as the black population, and when you get social problems of the magnitude that they now experience, you've got a crisis that dwarfs those of earlier decades.
And it really is unlike the problems Italian immigrants had 100 years ago, and the Irish, you read about, you know, there were riots and they had drinking problems and so forth.
Yeah, and the reason it's different is that with those Irish and those Italians, you still had communities that functioned in terms of marriage, in terms of the norms for men working, in terms of taking care of your kids. Not that they didn't have problems. Italian communities, Irish communities, and for that matter, Scots-Irish communities, to get to my forebears, were often drank too much, and men hit their wives too much, and there were problems. But the communities were functional in basic ways.
So how do we get to this situation?
It's really, with the advantage of hindsight, of course, pretty simple. White working class community. In the book Coming Apart, I use Fishtown, which was a working class community in Philadelphia, now gentrified.
Yeah, I was in Philadelphia for the Republican convention. It was a Democratic convention. Yeah, it is actually
completely gentrified. But the Fishtown was a classic, old, been there since the Revolution, working class, white working class communities. Okay, if you were in a Fishtown, or one of the many counterparts throughout the United States And you were a guy, you probably had a pretty good manufacturing or other kind of blue-collar job. It didn't make you rich. You know, the UAW kind of union jobs, really pretty small portion of the labor force. But you had a good job. You put a house over, a roof over your family, and put food on the table. You had a wife. You had a couple of kids. And all of this did a couple of things. One is it provided the family as the unit of organization of the community, which is real important for reasons we can come back to. But also, it gave you a real status in that community. You were one of the good guys. And a guy your age who wasn't supporting his wife, wasn't taking care of his kids, was a bum. He didn't have status, you did. Then you get the 1960s. You get the pill in the early 1960s, sexual revolution. You get the sudden preoccupation of the Democratic Party with blacks in the middle of the 1960s, which continues. Then in the late 60s, it adds women. And in the 70s, late 70s, is already beginning to add gays as the objects of the elite liberal affection and concern. And, you know, white working class guys not only are saying, well, what about us? They're actively the objects of scorn of the liberal elites. They are sexist. They are racist, and later they are homophobic. They are violent. They're guilty of abusing their wives and children. And in all sorts of ways, nobody stops to say, but, you know, most of you guys are still the soul of the earth, you what make America goes. That, there was none of that rhetoric. And there were lots of things that were dislocating. Plus, you got women going into the labor force. So all at once, the economic dependence that women had on men has gone away. And with that, then, you know, well, what happens if I leave? Maybe not so much, because not only is the wife making money, maybe she's making more than you are. So then along comes Reagan, and they like Reagan's rhetoric. They like his patriotism. Oh, by the way, a lot of these white working class guys had also been veterans of Vietnam. And when they came home, they couldn't wear their uniforms, because if they wore their uniforms on leave, they were spat on. Okay, so that goes into it. So Reagan appeals to them. They start voting for the Republicans. That coalition holds together for a while, but things don't get any better. They aren't making more money. Their wages are pretty stagnant. And their communities are starting to break down. That's when you start to have the guys who are still holding down jobs, but you have the other guys who maybe had an accident work, parlayed that into disability, now don't work at all, even though they could. You have guys working enough to qualify for unemployment benefits who then takes the next 3 or 4 months off. You watch around you people of color or women who get big settlements from employers because if they're fired, they charge that they've been harassed or sexually or racistly fired. So they are really, if you'll pardon the technical term, pissed off by 2016, and who can blame them? You have in this, though, two very different components, and I'll wrap up this here. You still have working class guys who are playing by the rules, who are getting married, taking care of their kids, working hard. I mean, we live in a part of the country where we know people. We actually hang out with a lot of people of the kind I'm talking about, and there are a whole lot of people who are doing the right things. There are also a whole lot of people who fit the other description I gave. Problem is they're in the same communities. So it's not as if the guys who are playing by the rules still live in functional communities. It's only the bad guys who don't. The whole thing is festering.
Was it inevitable that the, I think, you know, good faith efforts, presumably by, let's leave the liberals aside, by Clinton on the Democratic side, by Reagan and then Bush on the Republican side, all of whom thought they were speaking to these people, and I think probably honestly thought they had policies that would help them. Is it just overwhelmed by globalization and sort of social forces beyond politics, or was this could it have been very different?
Well, there are certain things you weren't going to change no matter what. You weren't going to change the sexual revolution. And let's not put the blame on feminism and women going out and becoming economically more independent. Guys also discovered, because of the sexual revolution, that they could get regular sexual access to a woman without marrying her. And that's a big deal if you're 22 years old or 18 years old. Even bigger deal later in life. But the point is that the rules had changed in ways that no politics were going to change, no matter what. But when it comes to the globalization, let me not speak to the left. Let me speak to the right here. Yeah. And a few mea culpas for people like you and me. Maybe it's not fair with you because I don't know exactly where you stood on immigration. But I was a big fan of globalization. And when I would read liberal accusations about Nike's sweatshops in Vietnam, well, I spent time in Southeast Asia. And I know very well that what they're calling sweatshops, in most cases, are the best jobs these people have ever had. And not only the best jobs they've ever had, offer the best chance for advancement, offer wages that are really quite good for the cost of living in those places. Best chance for the kids. So I was very benign about globalization. And I didn't pay much attention to what large-scale immigration meant in the United States. I read the economists, and you know of many of them, who say, when you look at it from a macroeconomic point of view, the immigrants are a plus-plus. They are not displacing Americans from jobs, etc. You're familiar with that right. Literature. I am willing to believe, on a macro sense, they may be right. It is also true, on a micro sense, there have also been many cases of guys who are making a decent wage as roofers and now can't make a decent wage as roofers because illegal immigrants are being hired by roofing companies at well below the rates, including payroll taxes, that have to be paid. That does happen, too. And just because it does not... It's not a big problem when you take it in terms right. of a nice econometric analysis using the current population survey. That doesn't mean it isn't a real problem in communities. Another thing that's going on here is the social science topic, perhaps, that we least like to talk about. And that is the effect of ethnic heterogeneity on social trust. It was Bob Putnam, of Bowling Alone fame, who brought this to public attention in a lecture he gave around 2006. What he found, and what others had already found, he was bringing to public attention something that had been percolating in academia, is that even after controlling for socioeconomic status, ethnic heterogeneity destroys social trust. Social trust is really important. Francis Fukuyama wrote a whole book about the importance of social trust for societies to function. But at the local level, it is absolutely crucial for the American civic culture to work. And it's not just that ethnic heterogeneity reduces social trust, it also reduces the trust within ethnicities. Hmm. So white people in that community don't trust as much each other as much as they used to. They hunker down, in Bob Putnam's phrase. Well, all this immigration, how did it affect you and me? Sorry to keep putting you in this situation. It provided opportunities for cheap gardeners and cheap nannies.
Right.
We do not live in communities. Well, actually, I do. But you don't live in a community in which right. you have a large Hispanic influx. And people who live in elite communities may have a lot of Asians moving in, but nobody worries about Asians because Asians have higher rates of school completion and intact families and everything than any other group has. So the people who bore the brunt of the social trust lost by increasing immigration was the working class. That was a big price.
Yeah, on immigration, I was sort of liberal in the middle of the last decade. I sort of vaguely supported the Bush-McCain attempts to have a big immigration reform. But I was against the 2013 Gang of Apes. I had become convinced that the costs, both of illegal and, I'd say, big legal immigration, were pretty great, the social costs. Yes, you say, whatever the net, you know, uh-huh. economic things. On the other hand, would it make much difference? And that's what I guess I come back to you. The flip side of it is, I mean, if you passed the dream conservative immigration, you know, policy tomorrow, built the wall, no illegals, and fewer illegals, or illegals would only come when they really were no Americans to do the job, or whatever you'd want to, you know, structure that immigration policy. I mean, is it symbolic as much, or is it real in terms of its effect?
Okay, let's specify what we're talking about, because I think we're talking about the same thing, because I would be in favor of this. Control the borders, and if that takes a wall, then so be it.
Right.
But use whatever measures are needed to control it. Then reduce the number of people who may legally immigrate here with low skills. Follow the Canadian model, follow other models which say, essentially, immigration is to be to the benefit of the United States of America. And if this makes us not want to read the base of the Statue of Liberty, so be it. The base of the Statue of Liberty about huddled masses was not part of the Constitution.
Right.
It is not a founding document.
Right. It was a policy that was worked for America in the late 19th century.
That's right.
Which incidentally was changed.
Yeah.
It was not the policy of America from 1924 to 1965.
And some would say it worked pretty well. The point being this, that that we just simply shift our attitude and say, we are going to look out for Americans first. And we're especially going to look out for working class Americans. Now, having said that, let's suppose that we manage to achieve all that. Will it then be the case that you have all these guys go out and take these jobs that may pay $15 or $17 an hour, but involves doing agricultural labor? It's hard for me to see that happening.
Right.
Because even right now, the stories are rife of the jobs that American won't take. These are not made up. If you go to any employer of low-skilled labor or even medium-skilled labor, they will tell you horror stories about trying to keep their payrolls filled with the kinds of skilled people they know. And they will also tell you horror stories about they hire a guy. And let's remind people who may have turned in late, we aren't talking about Latinos or blacks in the inner city. We're talking about white-bred, American, non-Latino males who take a job and they can't show up on time. They take half-hour toilet breaks frequently. They don't do a very good job when they actually do work. And eventually they're fired. And when they're fired, they are filled with indignation that the employer would throw them out when they were, you know, just they're doing a good job. It's not just that they don't work well. There seems to be a kind of inability to take responsibility for the fact that they failed. And this is very common. So would it make it any better if we had that kind of immigration policy? I think so, but I think it would be at the margin. And I think that it would take something more dramatic than that to restore anything like the work ethic and the cultural expectations that we had 50 years ago.
I take it you would say the same thing about trade. I mean, Trump has made a big deal of trade policy, and it's resonated more than I would have expected. It's not been historically a winning issue in America. The protectionist attempts, rhetoric of way back, Gephardt and Buchanan and a lot of people in both parties have tried it and never quite succeeded. There's always been some sentiment that way. I think I underestimated. I'm just talking to people out on the campaign trail a little bit, reporters and stuff. The trade lines in the speech get huge applause. I mean, I don't know that it's empirically true that it makes much difference. And again, it's very hard to imagine a world in 2016 where we're putting up much in the way of trade barriers, honestly.
This is where I'm going to stand at the barricade, because I'm willing to say I'm with the idea of restricting low-skill immigration, severely restricting it. I think that if there is one economic principle that every economist I know who I respect says, trade is a win-win, that if we restrict trade, the quality of living in the United States is going to go down, not just for people at the top, it's going to go way down for people who shop at Walmarts and are really need to get an inexpensive product.
And I would say, you've made this point, I think also that also, the effect of trade in helping hundreds of millions, I guess billions by now, of very poor people around the world is not trivial. In India and China, their success depends on a more or less free trading or open trading and open capital regime worldwide. And that's not a insignificant moral accomplishment to help those people lift themselves out of poverty. Conversely, it would not be an insignificant moral problem, I would say.
I guess that I have shifted enough. I agree, by the way, with everything you said about the moral value of what we have done. I would be more sympathetic to say, yeah, but I'd like to make sure we're okay in this country with our workers, our low-income people, if I thought trade modifications would do that. Yeah. And I am not convinced of that. I think Adam Smith in Wealth of Nations laid out the case for open trade. I don't know of any effective refutation of that by anybody. I don't know of any serious economist who doesn't see that as pretty much as valid now as it was in 1776.
So that's interesting that you would distinguish immigration and trade. So those issues are often lumped together, and I mean Trump himself does, and on the counter Trump side, people lump them together as kind of examples of the response.
I think it's an empirical matter.
Yeah,
I think it's way easier to demonstrate that there are no significant harms that free trade does to low-income American workers, whereas the attempts to demonstrate that large immigration doesn't hurt low-skill is a lot dicier.
And the cultural effects of large-scale immigration
are
the cultural
effects
of shirts being made in China are presumably
not very
great, whereas the cultural effects of people not speaking the language and tensions between communities and stuff are.
Yeah.
I'm curious, what do you think about this? I've been struck by this. People say working class, and you've been sort of focusing on, at least in the book, you focus on what we would consider kind of classic working class, you know, assembly line, people working mostly with their bodies, so to speak. But I'm struck, I live in Fairfax County, which is an upscale county, but like most areas of the U.S., it's mixed, and there are parts of it that have quite a lot of immigrants, actually, and aren't very well off. And so if you go to some of the, you know, there are 23 high schools in Fairfax County, and I'm going to make this up and say that, you know, 19 of them are pretty just upper middle class, like but three or four more, you know, mix. Not everyone goes to college. Some of the kids drop out. They have disciplinary problems and stuff. And I'm struck talking to, for example, a woman who has been a teacher and an administrator in the Fairfax County schools, how upset she is about the fact that she joined that school system. It was great. It had some poor kids. Everyone worked hard. You know, everyone was expected to learn English. There was discipline in the classroom. And it was a fulfilling job to be a teacher or move up in the Fairfax County school system. And now you go to some of these schools, and the kids aren't disciplined, and there are all kinds of constraints on what you can do as a teacher, and there are other bureaucratic problems. And I wonder how much, I mean, I'll use Trump here as a kind of more of a metaphor than an actual, I don't know if she's voting for Trump, this person I was talking to, but there's sort of a Trumpian echo in the middle class as well. And that would be someone I would say we would consider middle class. If, you know, two teachers, that's not really quite our conventional working class, you know, person. But I think there's more of that than people think, which is probably one reason why Trump is getting more votes than he would get if he only were getting, you know, unemployed or underemployed assembly line workers.
In effect, what it sounds like what that teacher that you're using there is saying is, I chose to work in a school system where I thought I was going to get a bunch of upper middle class kids that I could teach.
Lower middle class kids who would be disciplined and have families that would reinforce my teaching and wouldn't tell the kid to ignore the teacher and whatever.
And so, I'm going to say it's a she, just reflecting my generation and my assumptions about who the teacher is. She knows very well that if she'd accepted a job in most inner-city schools, it's not a matter that the kids were black that was a problem or that they were poor that was a problem, but she wouldn't have been able to teach because we all know about the problems that the inner-city schools have had, that the teachers are held powerless to do anything about. And what she is seeing in her situation as all at once this school is more and more like an inner city school has been in the past,
is
the spread of the new lower class, as I call it, in coming apart, which is very similar to what we used to call the underclass in the black inner city. She is seeing the spread, and I would be willing to bet that whereas it may be some of the immigrant kids who are causing the problem, an awful lot of what's causing the problem are white kids who are from working class areas that are disintegrating. We are seeing the future in terms of By the way, all of this, there's no magic formula says that this stops at the working class.
Well, I was going to ask about that. So in the book, Coming Apart, which everyone should read, of course, and which we discussed in the previous conversation, which everyone should watch, Fishtown, what's the break? You say, let's look at the top, the bottom.
Yeah, I have my
you leave the middle out.
My upper middle class is college educated, and it has with a person who's the head of household who has either a managerial job or a professional job. That's one end. The other end is a couple who has no more than high school education, and if anybody's working in the family, it's no more than blue collar job.
And what are the sort of rough numbers on each of those categories?
Oh dear! Asking me numbers from book
quarter,
I published 4 years.
But I mean,
we're talking basically on a quarter and a quarter.
That's what I remember.
It's 20 and 30.
So half of America's in
20 on top, 30 on the bottom, and the other 50 in the middle.
So it's kind of an important question: what happens to the 50 in the middle?
There are a whole bunch of graphs.
Spent some work on it and thought about. Right? I mean, yeah. It would make a big difference if the 30 in the bottom were constrained. If 30's bad, but if 30% of the country's having trouble and 70% isn't, that's one thing. If the 30% is spreading to 40 and 50. That's a very different situation.
Well, I had, with all of these graphs that I published in the book, I had two lines, and one was defined as the upper middle class, and the other was the working class. I also plotted, what about the middle 50?
Right.
So I have all those graphs sitting in my computer, and they were pretty boring in that they were exactly in the middle.
Uh-huh.
So that if the working class was going down like this, and the upper middle class is sort of like this, the middle class is going like that. There was deterioration in the middle class. And the deterioration was the same kind of a drop down in marriage and an increase in out of the workforce. And all of you have to think about all of that in terms of what is coming down the pike with the middle class with regard to the availability of jobs, which is that we are looking over the next 10, 15 years to a massive hollowing out of jobs, and not just in the working class, but in the middle class.
Why?
Artificial intelligence has finally started to live up to its hype. Now, there are all sorts of ways in which IT has already supplanted white-collar jobs. I used a travel agent all the time in the 1990s, because I traveled a lot. And I'm sure she made quite a good living. I also am quite confident that her IQ was just fine, and I wouldn't be surprised if she had a college education, so she made a good living. She was doing a job that required lots of judgments, lots of ability to research various alternatives, and she was earning her money. Around 2003, when Expedia got pretty good and the United Airlines website got pretty good, I gave up using a travel agent. And the actual number of travel agents, I looked it up because I was struck by that, and it indeed has dropped, I think, by more than a third since the turn of the century. But the real big news is this. Are you familiar with the Japanese game of Go?
Slightly, very slightly.
Okay, so you know the chessboard is 8x8, and each side has 16 pieces, and the pieces move in a defined way, and it's all very linear. If, then, if, then, if, then. And so, in fact, it took them a long time, but they made really good programs to play chess, and now you can buy one for $35 that can beat the world champion. Fine. Go is on a board that is larger than that and has nodes on it. I'm not sure the exact size, but even small increases produce exponential increases in possibilities. And you just put pebbles on these nodes and different colored pebbles, and the object is to encircle, and it's all very intuitive. So a great deal of intelligence is needed to play Go, but it's way different from chess. And the assumption last year was that it would be another 10 years before a chess program could beat Go. This spring, a program was developed by a subsidiary of Google, who else, that beat one of the leading Go players 4 games out of 5. And the reason why it's worth telling this story is they didn't teach the program how to play Go. They taught the program how to teach itself to do things. And so what they did was feed the program a couple of thousand games that had been played of Go by senior players. They fed it to the rules of Go and said, okay, that's it. Thereupon, the program proceeds to play millions and millions and millions of games of Go. and learn from them. And, if I make this move, that out of the 75 million games that I played, it has this effect on my probability of winning or losing. And you just keep building that up, and the result is it plays world-class Go. That algorithm that says, just let the program teach itself. Imagine applying that to medical diagnosis. Imagine applying that to all sorts of things. And imagine analogous kinds of programs and AI and all sorts of jobs that are currently held by people who make a fairly limited amount of judgments, but demanding judgments, are going to be replaceable by a computer program within that not long period of time.
I guess the conventional...
We've been saying that for 200 years.
Right, and they'll produce, other jobs and more leisure and so forth. But
I can't tell you how often I hear that.
Well,
because they have the advantage of having been right for 200 years. For 200 years, people have said, oh, look, we're going to automate the mills and we lose all these jobs. And, of course, other things rise up. But with most of those, even though hindsight helps, it is also true if the automobile is coming in and you do see that a lot of horse drivers are going to be out of a job, carriage drivers. Well, if somebody needs to drive the automobile, somebody needs to fix the automobile. So you could sort of see that. But tell me, when the probably within the next 10 years, 4-odd million people are going to be out of work driving cars and trucks because of they'll be driverless. It's a whole lot harder to see how that spins off jobs. And as you look at the developments at Google and Apple and Microsoft and the rest, we've had wonderful new capabilities that really have not generated very many jobs.
Right.
And I think basically you're going to make out like a bandit if you have an IQ of 135 and above, and otherwise things are looking pretty grim. Or if you are very conscientious. I will just throw that in since we're talking about jobs. I'm borrowing from Tyler Cowen here. Tyler Cowen points out that we're still going to need nannies for our children. We're really going to need people to take care of our elderly parents. And what do we want for those jobs? First, we want a human being. We really, I don't care how good the robot is. We want a human being. We want a nurturing human being. And above all, we want a conscientious human being who, even though nobody's looking over his or her shoulder, will do a prescribed thing as asked, no matter what, such as administer the pills that are due at 4:30. Mm-hmm. Now, which gender tends to be more nurturing and more conscientious? Statistically, we have many conscientious men. We have many nurturing men. Statistically, women have a big, big edge. So our white-collar, working-class male has yet another way in which he's going to end up at the bottom of the totem pole.
Oh, that's almost the white-collar, middle-class male, too, though, right?
Yeah.
So you think there you get a kind of a perfect storm of the technology plus the social mores.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's cheerful.
Cheerful is what I do. You know
yeah,
that, Bill.
That's right. No, but that's important. Well, are there any, obviously, there's no magic bullets, at least. But is there? Where would that incline you in terms of, if one had that analysis in terms of policies, either macro or micro?
Well, it's pushed me toward a universal basic income, which I wrote a book on in 2006 called In Our Hands, and which I've just redone with new arithmetic for today's economy, and. I think it is important enough that I'll take a few minutes and just tell what's going on with that.
Someone told me that your new introduction to it is very interesting, but I haven't seen it yet. Is it coming out soon? Or?
It's out, yeah. You can go to Amazon and you can download it in your Kindle.
Speaking of businesses that are destroying
yeah,
a lot of
exactly
middle class.
Right.
Because, being a bookseller, working in a book, that was a kind of middle class, college educated job, right?
The examples are legion. Well, the idea of a universal basic income appeals to me in part as a way of solving an economic problem because, as is highly publicized, we are looking at a growth of entitlement spending that is really scary and unsustainable deficits unless we do a major fix. So there will have to be a major fix of some kind, and so I want to draw people's attention now to a quite affordable fix, which will have the advantage of being affordable. That's not really my main reason for proposing it. The basics are this. At the age of 21, every American who holds a passport, which is issued at birth and has the same function as an ordinary passport, but also establishes your eligibility as an American citizen for the Universal Basic Income, UBI, starts to receive a monthly deposit electronically to a known bank account of 13,000 divided by 12. 13,000 is the total basic income, of which 3,000 must be devoted to health care, which I'm going to push aside because it's a complicated additional topic. So you have 10,000 of disposable income that you're getting in monthly allotments. Well, I think that there are all sorts of ways to do that which would cause catastrophe. I think if we simply add that on to the current benefit system, it's not affordable, and it also is a catastrophe. But what if it replaces everything else? There's no more Medicare, no more health insurance, Social Security. There's no more welfare. There's no more corporate welfare. There's no more agricultural subsidies. I can go through the whole list of transfers. There's none of that stuff, and there's also none of the bureaucracies that administer it. You have $10,000, and you say, well, you can't live on $10,000. Well, if you really want to live all by yourself, no, you'll live a pretty grubby existence on $10,000. You get a minimum wage job, just a minimum wage job, and you work 2,000 hours a year at, let's say, $750. That's $15,000 plus 10, that's $25,000. Yeah, that's well above, way above the poverty line. Well, suppose for some reason you can't work, or just suppose you don't want to work. You can still have a decent existence if you're cooperative. If you're cooperative enough to convince a friend, a girlfriend or boyfriend, a relative or something else to pool your resources, if you just do it with two people, you got 20. With no working whatsoever, you got 30 if you got three people. You add a little bit of income and you're in the middle class. That $10,000 given to everyone has a huge effect on their ability to live a decent existence by doing reasonable things. But it also has, I think, a couple of other huge advantages, again, because of some features of my specific plan, which I'm quite proud of. One is, right now, we claw back benefits at a very low rate. So that if you're on food stamps and Medicare, and you take a job, you very soon face a very punitive loss of benefits. I say, look, you keep your entire $10,000. We don't claw back a cent of it until you have $30,000 in earned income. Once you have $31,000 in earned income, you'll pay $50 or some very minor clawback, and that'll increase as your income rises. But I'm really saying to somebody who's gotten up to $30,000 of earned income, okay, you now got a net of 40. You really want to quit work and go back to 10?
Yeah.
I'm luring them in to work until they can't quit. And the other thing that I really like about it is that it reverses some really terrible incentives. For example, the people who do not work because they're afraid of losing their benefit, that all disappears. They go to work, they're pure profit for them to go to work, whereas now it can be very punitive. The second thing is, consider the classic case of the young woman who has a baby and no husband. Well, it is a statement of fact that under the current system that generates an income stream she would not have otherwise had. I'm not saying she has the baby to get the income stream. I'm saying it does generate an income stream. Under the plan I'm proposing, she has an income stream. The baby is going to be a major drain on that income stream. Now, that can also be good. All of us who have children have a major drain on our income streams as a result that we're delighted to have. But it does get the incentives right. I really want a baby. I know I'm going to be paying for diapers and baby food and all that, and I still want the baby. Okay. But if you've got the income stream, And you say, gee, do I really want to spend it on those kinds of things? Or do I want to spend it on some more education or better clothes or something? That gets those incentives right. And I'll add one other incentive it gets really right, which has to do with men who walk away from their children. I am not a big fan of demonizing single women. I understand all the reasons we want to hesitate at that, even if we think the women have made a wrong decision. I don't see a thing wrong with demonizing single men who walk away from children. I'm very easy with that. Well, we have child support laws in place. We have DNA such that all you need to get is a swab, and you can have absolute certainty of paternity. And we've got an electronic bank account known. All the judge has to do is garnish a certain amount of money from the man to support his children. You think that will get around? You think other men will know that that's happening? You think that maybe that just might make them think twice before they father a child they don't plan to take care of? I'm quite enthusiastic about those incentives.
Could it happen? I think part of it could. I mean, the Medicare stuff strikes me as hard because...
The medical thing is hard.
Because people think that's a separate category.
Yeah, and you know, where I'm willing...
Catastrophic costs and so forth.
Where I'm willing to compromise is on the medical side. I mean, the reality is we run an idiotic medical system. And part of the things I go through in the book is to point out to people, do you realize that the costs of ordinary medical care, the kind that are 90% of the reasons we go to doctors, should have been going steadily down over the last half century, the same way that the costs of everything else have been going down? But because it is sui generis in so many ways, I'll say, okay, let's put aside medical care and talk about the rest of this. But I guess I want to add on to this kinds of specific benefits I've talked about, something that just might make a difference to white-collar guys who can't get jobs and to a changing job market. It has a good chance, and I will express it that way. I can't be sure. It has a really good chance of revitalizing America's civic culture. The idea is this. You have people who are not going to use their money wisely. We all know that. And they're going to smoke it up or drink it up or whatever. And so it's going to be the 18th of the month, and they're down and out. Well, how are they going to survive to the end of the month? They got to go to somebody, but there's no government agency to go to anymore. Those are all gone. So they got to go to the boyfriend, the girlfriend, the sister, the brother, the relative, the friend, or whatever.
Church.
Or the church. Local, you know. In each of these cases, the situation has been fundamentally changed. Right now, that person can present himself as being a helpless victim. So many strikes have gone against me in life, and much of which may be true. But when there's another $800 hitting the bank account in 2 weeks, the dialogue changes. Hmm. We're not going to let you starve, but don't tell us you're helpless. You aren't helpless. We know what your situation is. It's time for you to get your act together. And now take these kinds of interactions and multiply them by tens of millions. And think of all the ways in which if there are not government agencies to do things, that philanthropic efforts which have been diverted away from those, as we know from scholarly work, they have been diverted away. What happens if they are diverted again in, and we get to the whole issue of my own very deep belief that human needs are solved best at the lowest possible level, that the government is a blunt, extremely inefficient method for dealing with human needs, that American history is replete with real brilliance in our ability to use civic culture to meet human needs. So that's my baby when it comes to trying to solve some of the problems that I've been talking about.
That's good. You know, for me, what's most striking and I guess depressing about the current moment with Trump and Trumpism is I had sort of high hopes for the Tea Party and for the revival of a kind of appreciation of constitutionalism, limited government, kind of Hayekian understanding that central planning didn't work. People didn't read Hayek exactly, but there's a sort of instinctive, I think, sense of that, that the modern nanny state, welfare state, administrative state was had all kinds of perverse bad effects, both in terms of actual policy outcomes and in terms of citizenship, as you were just talking about. That seemed to be getting more and more currency, I would say, over the last several years in both scholarship and a lot of popular kind of discussion, really. Trump does not seem to embody any of that, though. So the populist movement just went in a very different direction. I don't know, did you expect it? Do you have an account of it?
I was smiling because I was exactly the same place you were. I loved the original Tea Party movement. I loved the saying, let's put social issues aside, let's just agree on limited government. I loved the energy and the enthusiasm. I really thought that we might be in a situation where we have a change in political culture that really cements a lot of the founders' ideas about how government works. So what went wrong? And I guess an awful lot of people who have voted Republican never were part of that. They weren't part of the Tea Party. They were voting Republicans because essentially the Democrats dissed them. Not only didn't do anything for them, but in addition to that, dissed them and condescended to them. And the Republicans didn't. But then all of their grievances, the Republicans don't seem to be paying any attention to. In part, unrealistically, because the government, they don't have the presidency, and you can put bills on the president's desk, but it's not very useful exercise if no, they aren't going to pass. In part, realistically, insofar as the issues we talked about earlier, where we, people like you and me, just didn't think that hard about how important limiting low-skill immigration was. So they got a spokesman. And in this sense, what you're saying is, here was a section of the party that was always out there. We underestimated its size. They get a spokesman. They rally to that spokesman. And then if we were really prescient, we would have said, gee, if you've got 17 candidates and only one person's really trying to appeal to that, that one person is going to get more votes than anybody else.
And he's a celebrity, and he's a very skillful.
All of these things I say now, and I hadn't a clue all throughout Trump's success, and I'm as wrong as everybody else has been. What is scary is that it is so opposite to the whole notion of just leave us alone to live our lives as we see fit. The populism that is out there now is very much focused on using big government to give us what we need, and if that includes an enforcement army to kick 8 million people out of the country, so be it. And that's a nascent kind of nationalist party that America has never had, and to be honest about it, they have conducted a hostile takeover of the Republican Party.
Yeah, and do you think, I mean, I guess the one question is, if Trump loses, this is hard to know, of course, some people think, well, he loses, it was a fluky thing, 17 candidates, he's a celebrity, he's very skillful, but you kind of go back to where you were with Scott Walker and Marco Rubio and all these candidates. It's not like the Republican Party's gone away, Paul Ryan, they're all still in office. Or, and this is a little closer to where I think I am, it doesn't just go away. I mean, Trump, there will be other Trumps or mini
Trumps. It's 1852.
You think,
1852, I mean, that's, again, this is my view, that all at once the Whigs, and I'm not an expert, by the way, on Whig history, but my sense is they lost their purpose, they lost their cohesiveness in ways which have lots of parallels. My own view is you probably need to have a new party for people like you and me to be in. I don't think the Republican Party is going to be a congenial place for us anymore.
Because it will be a nationalist, populist, non-limited government, non-rule of law party.
Well, point number one is, Bill, that as you know, I am the world's least qualified political analyst. But having said that, the nationalist energy is not going to go away with Trump. We now know that about 35%, certainly of the Republican electorate, but maybe not that much smaller a percent of the entire national is sympathetic to those nationalists. My sense is that when there is that kind of a market out there, there's going to be somebody ready to satisfy that market. And you and I, and a lot of our friends, cannot be part of a party like that.
And then more broadly, what strikes me, I kind of think it compounds the point or intensifies the point, is that 45% of the votes cast in this 2016 primary season were cast for Trump or Sanders, almost the exact same number on each side. Obviously, in Trump's case, the 45% was a winning number, and Sanders' case, it was a losing number to Clinton. But that's pretty striking. I mean, yeah. If you believe in some broad American constitutional, you know, liberal, conservative, whatever, you know, system, the one thing America's done a pretty good job of excluding, I would almost say, is socialism on the one hand and populist authoritarianism on the other. There have been many times when what has risen up, especially the populist authoritarianism, but it was at the state level or it failed, and Huey Long or George Wallace and whatever. And it is a little startling. And we're not in the middle of the Great Depression. We're not in the middle of a, you know, taking tens of thousands of casualties in a war.
But we
it's a little startling that 45% of the public basically have voted for candidates. And I don't really even say this pejoratively. I just think analytically, who kind of reject the mainstream of American politics for the last 60, 70 years, you know, arguably for longer than that when you think about it.
I would summarize in many ways as saying that what we used to substitute for nationalism was the American way of life, which now I'm sure is used only sarcastically or in a lot of cases historically as what people used to say. But it was 60 years ago, the American way of life had meaning, and whereas there are lots of different meanings that could be assigned to it, a great deal of it had to do with the dignity and importance of the common man and the dignity and importance of the family. And that if you did a few basic things in the United States, you were as good as the richest man in the country. And that was really believed. The idea that you weren't supposed to be upper class. America doesn't have an upper class. We have regular Americans and people who pretend to be an upper class, like the New York 400, they're the anomalies. That the real American rich people are out there in Cleveland and Des Moines and Topeka and so forth. And yeah, they have companies, but they're members of their lodges and they engage in the community activities. The American way of life, which is distinct from the American dream, which is, you know, upward and onward, but the American way of life was our nationalism, and it no longer is.
Oh, that's interesting. How much of it is, you know, actual facts on the ground don't support, if I can put it that way, the American way of life anymore because of challenges in wages, because of family decomposition? It's just, you know, more of the country is unable to say this is the America we live in. And how much of it is people's attitudes somehow being, I don't know, unrealistic? I mean, you could say, you know, it's a kind of spoiled. I mean, with Sanders promising free everything and Trump promising, in a way, a version, I would say, of free everything, build the wall. You know, just, I mean, sort of very simplistic policy solutions, to say the least. I mean, how much, what does it say about our public culture? I mean, does it say more about the reality of America, or does it say more about the psychology of Americans, I guess?
Maybe. I think it says more about where America is on its trajectory. And here I have been seeing recently a whole bunch of parallels. I'm not alone in seeing these. A whole bunch of parallels between the United States and a mature civilization that's on the downhill slide. And just to name a few of them, it is really true, historically true, that what made America exceptional and made it possible for us to call ourselves the land of the free really was the original Constitution with its enumerated powers and the rest of it, which really was operative for all practical purposes up until 1937. And from 1937 to 1942, a series of Supreme Court decisions did not incrementally change the Constitution. They explicitly said, we will henceforth interpret these age-old precepts differently. There are no more enumerated powers. There is no more requirement that Congress make spell out what it wants in legislation. It can give authority to regulatory agencies, and so forth and so on. So that's one thing that changed. And so America from 1943 on, let's say, was prospectively pretty much like every other Western democracy. It took a long time for a lot of these constitutional changes to be realized in practice, but that was going to happen. Then you had the creation of a real, honest-to-God new upper class, which is also characteristic of mature civilizations that have evolved into a layer cake. In our case, the layer cake was driven by a few good things, such as giving people of all abilities a shot at a good education. That's a good thing, but it also tends to create a new upper class, which a number of us have commented upon, and now exists as a class that sees itself as better than the rest of the country, better able to make decisions for the rest of the country, and also enjoys a culture of their own. Another sign to me of a country in decline is an upper class that no longer sets the standard for the rest of the society. Whether it's Roman civilization or Victorian England, the new upper class, they were the ones who said this is the way decent people are supposed to live, and it should embody virtue, and the new upper class saw it as their responsibility to live that way themselves, to say that's the way that you ought to behave. We have none of that. We have what I like to call ecumenical niceness as the code of behavior of the new upper class. And then you have, just in case you aren't clinically depressed yet, Bill.
You're doing a good job, Tony.
You have Mansur Olson. And Mansur Olson, who taught us, elaborating on the Federalist Papers and faction, that advanced democracies develop institutional sclerosis. That there is an asymmetry between the ability of a small group of people who want to use the levers of democracy to carve out a special interest and the ability to organize a large number of people who don't really want that but don't care that much. And what we have had in the United States of America is the accumulation of hundreds of thousands of things that are locked in. And the reason Mansur Olson called it institutional sclerosis is it clogs up the arteries. And there are lots of reasons to believe that government right now is really deeply clogged up. I'm reminded of a saying of Irving Kristol's that I cherish and repeat to myself like a mantra on occasion. I was talking to Irving about this, and I'm sure he said it to people besides me. And he said, yes, the country's going to hell, but it will take a long time and we can enjoy ourselves in the meantime.
Yeah.
that's pretty much where I feel right now.
That's encouraging. I guess what's so striking, though, is that in our adult lifetimes, there seem to be moments where people internalized the Mansur Olson thesis. People understood it. There were serious thought was given by political scientists, Jim Wilson and others. What kind of reforms could break it up? How would one restore a kind of constitutionalism? It was very impressive in a way what Bork and Scalia and others did in terms of constitutional law, and there's a lot of students of theirs and offshoots, and then quarrels between different kinds of originalists. But that's in a way healthy. I mean, the degree to which free market economics, constitutionalism, and law gained from 1970, let's say, to 2000 is pretty, there was nowhere, right, in 1970. Hayek wasn't read, Friedman was was a tiny little school. Your work didn't exist yet. I had the thought that, these are deep trends that it's hard to fight, but there seemed to be quite a lot of intelligent and sort of impressive reaction against them, intellectual reaction, and to some degree political reaction. Paul Ryan is someone who studied some of these things and thought hard about how do you take it.
But what have we done?
But what happened?
For that matter, take one of the key bad things about the administrative state, which is that the courts have explicitly said they will defer to the judgment of the regulatory agency in complex cases. Because the court is not expert in this, and so if the regulatory agency says this is the interpretation, they will tend to defer. It's known as Chevron deference, and there was a case brought which challenged a core component of Chevron Shepard's. The court overthrew it, and the opinion for the majority was written by Antonin Scalia. Yeah,
he was rethinking that, I think, late in life. And
He had
Thomas and some of the others were against that deference.
I mean,
that
you have had others, and but the fact is that Scalia, and he wrote it because he was trying to say to Congress, I think,
yeah,
I interpret it this way,
you should
Congress, it, this is your job. Stop trying to pull the up. But of course, Congress refuses to take up his job.
He was trying to curb the courts, but
he was trying. Yeah,
the price of that was not curbing the administrative agencies.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, maybe the challenge is much greater. I mean, you combine the sort of sclerotic government institution issue and the cultural changes and the other sort of things that are kind of built in, you might almost say, to a modern society. It's hard to, you know, hard to fight on that many fronts at once, perhaps. And it does seem with Trump we got temporarily, perhaps, have been overwhelmed on that front. Let me ask you finally about The Bell Curve, extremely impressive and interesting book. I guess you're most controversial, and that's saying something.
Yeah.
20 years ago, I think, right?
Yeah, 22.
How does it stand up in your opinion? I mean, thinking on this last topic we're talking about, I mean, that really foresaw the, by raising this issue of IQ that no one wants to think about, the, I don't know what the right term for it is exactly, meritocracy, or, you know, a sort of the layer cake or whatever, the way in which good intentions and good policies that we would probably defend, letting people into universities based on merit, not on birth and not on family name and so forth, and then people marrying each other from those universities, which again is fine, and you can't very well object to it, and their kids then going to those universities, and given how much of IQ is hereditary, and given that the environment that those kids are going to have is better anyway, because the parents will
have done
well.
It's a very good summary you're doing in the book, Bill.
Is that doing okay? Well, no, but this is all aside from all the scientific work you and Richard Herrnstein did on the actual IQ question. But, I mean, so 20 years later, is it more that way? I mean, is there anything you missed? Is there anything different that you would
I think
say?
That when Dick and I predicted the emergence of a cognitive elite, I don't think anybody would say we're wrong at this point.
I mean, that was a term you used, cognitive elite,
back in 1994.
That is really early.
Yeah, and people don't realize that I recycled, in the first couple of chapters of Coming Apart, I recycled the material in The Bell Curve on the development of this cognitive elite. I said I was doing it in a footnote, but none of the reviewers of the book noticed because nobody really read The Bell Curve. The interesting thing about The Bell Curve, I will say very quickly, is there any scientific assertion in The Bell Curve which has been overturned? The answer is no, and because we were so extremely cautious. But The Bell Curve is going to become relevant again for a reason that was not The Bell Curve's topic, and that has to do with group differences. Because the genome has been decoded, we are now identifying specific single nucleotide polymorphisms known as SNPs, which are the thing that determine differences. We've identified hundreds of those related to educational attainment, which of course is a proxy measure for IQ. We're learning lots about the genetic determinants of personality characteristics. We're learning lots about the physiological differences between men and women and cognitive differences and the rest. And the short statement is, and again, I stress it's not the top of the bell curve, but it's what created the controversy about the bell curve, that we are going to, we, the geneticists, which do not include me, are going to unravel this story over the next 10 years, to a large degree.
Well,
the picture won't be complete in 10 years, but the progress in doing it is exponential. They have extremely powerful new methods of doing it. And for those with eyes to see, it is already quite clear, which should be obvious to everyone and it should not be scary to anyone. Groups of people are different. I'm not talking about whites and blacks. I'm talking about Welshmen and Irishmen, for heaven's sakes. I'm talking about French and Germans. That there are all sorts of ways in which groups of people who have been identified sociologically or anthropologically as groups are also different genetically, and they will have different outcomes in life for reasons that are genetic in origin and are not the fault of the unfairness of society, and that goes in spades for males and females. All of this runs against the prevailing, it's more than political convention, it's dogma. The dogma is that if men and women are different in important outcomes of life, it's the result of the unfairness of structures and systems. If blacks and whites are different in outcomes of life, et cetera, et cetera. We are facing over the next 10 years a headlong crash between a deeply held dogma of the social sciences and the way the world works as revealed by the physical sciences. And I must say I am looking forward to it as I'm fighting Schadenfreude as right. a problem at this right. point, because it's going to be a story that we should have known is coming. It is coming. But I do want to say on record, it's not a story to be scared of. Human beings are not stacked into superior to inferior groups, neither are sexes. But it's way different than the university wants things to be.
But it's not inconsistent with the American way of life or the principles of the Declaration or
exactly.
the founding.
Exactly.
I'm asking, is that right? I
mean, no, yeah.
It shouldn't be understood as a challenge to that particularly.
The answer to all of this, we must treat people as individuals. And if you treat people as individuals, the fact that you have different distributions, it becomes meaningless. Because if you're an astrophysicist with an IQ of 145 and you happen to be an African-American, you're still an astrophysicist with an IQ of 145. And the same goes for any kind of stereotype about people. That you just treat people as individuals. But Bill, I say that which is the American ideal. That's what we were founded on. And now you think of the enormous structure for treating people by groups that pervades the law and practice in this country. Are we just going to throw all that out?
Yeah.
What's going to happen when the material hits the fan?
And people can deny reality a long time. You know, I mean, it's nice to think that when my father famously said that a neoconservative is a liberal who's been mugged by reality, that was very clever, not quite true accurate, I'd say, because in fact neoconservatives had thought more about these things than the mugged by reality, conveys. But Mike Scully, I don't know if you remember him, a young man who died quite young, unfortunately, was sort of a protege of my dad's. There were all these neoliberals in the early 80s, Gary Hart and those people who were kind of trying to accommodate some of the criticisms of the Great Society, but still be kind of more big government welfare state people. And they wrote a lot of things. And I think Mike, I'm not sure if Mike wrote this or said this, but it's in the oral tradition anyway. Mike said that a neoliberal is a liberal who's been mugged by reality and refuses to press charges. Which I think is a very deep, I've repeated that, I've said that a couple of times probably in these conversations, but I think it's a very deep insight. I mean, people have a great ability, nations have a great ability, whole intellectual classes have a great ability to not, to get mugged by reality and resist it for a long time. Now, ultimately, one assumes one pays a price for that, and, you know, the Soviet Union comes tumbling down and so forth, but you can have a lot of resistance and a lot of damage done in the resistance, actually.
Let me offer why I think this time will be different.
Good.
Look, if Dick Hernstein and I present data based on correlations and patterns within the data and scores on subtests of the IQ in trying to infer such things as genetic role, all of that, you can argue that from kingdom to kingdom come, and they have. It doesn't make any difference how good your analysis was and how strongly the weight of data is on your side. It can always be litigated endlessly. Hard science is different. There are ways of overturning the findings of hard science, but it's a very demanding thing. You have common ground rules everybody has to play by. At this point, they are able to predict about 10% of educational achievement purely on the basis of specific locations within the gene. And that we're at the very bottom of this curve. What happens when you can explain 30%, 40%? How do you argue against that being true? You can't do it the same way you can argue against social science data. I take your point about people resisting to extraordinary lengths. this is going to be a kind of challenge they have not had to face before. And I think that cognitive dissonance is going to come into play here too.
Right.
Because I think a lot of the academics who have asserted they believe X about a gender topic or a racial topic or whatever already don't believe it. And this is going to cause a cognitive dissonance problem there too.
That will be interesting. We'll have to have a conversation about that. When does this sort of, I'm sorry to tell, of course, but is there inflection point, do you think, when, I mean, are we talking about something that's 2 years away or 10 years away?
I'll be serious. I think that 3 years.
Really?
That we will know so much in 3 years that it will then start to seep into the mainstream media. I mean, it's already out there. But, of course, nobody has to pay attention to it yet. But I follow this literature closely, and hardly a week goes by that there's not a new thing being published. I think it's only a couple of years away.
We will have to have a conversation about it in less than a couple of years.
That will
even.
Be fun.
That sounds great. Thank you, Charles.
My pleasure.
And thank you for joining us on Conversations.